This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Even as pandemic deaths in Europe and the United States may be cresting, we hope, we're already seeing extreme weather in parts of the world. Australian researcher David Spratt, author of Code Red, explains threats from simultaneous pandemic and climate change. From Detroit, food organizer Malik Yakini reports from an African-American community in grief, in hope, and in a wave of new interest in local food. On any other day, on any other planet, David Spratt would be my first guest. Even as the financial system teeters toward the precipice of our Great Depression, David's new report shows how the old economy was a deadly threat to civilization itself, to our continued existence here, and there's science to back that up. 2 or 3 weeks ago, I told Radio EcoShock listeners to buy seeds. This week, Johnny's, one of the largest in the U.S., and Stokes, the biggest in Canada, both posted notices on their websites. They no longer sell seeds to the public. All remaining seed, they say, must go to commercial growers to ensure the food supply. There was a sudden rash of would-be homegrown buyers getting those seeds, and they are uneasy about the food supply. Like the grocery stores, the unexpected wave of consumer demand for basics cleaned out the system, except for commercial buyers. Our guest Malik Yakini runs the biggest urban farm in Detroit. Calls from residents there wanting to have help with their gardens flooded foodfirst.org. Meanwhile, back in the United States, forget the supermarkets, the rest of America eats through food banks, charity pantries, shelters, and school meals. With 17 million newly unemployed, demand for food in the last few weeks has just soared through the roof. It's like a war zone there in the food banks where those volunteers work almost as long as the nurses in the hospitals. They're stuffing boxes for the lineups outside. As Nina Lacchini reports in The Guardian, quote, in Amherst, home to the University of Massachusetts' largest campus, the pantry distributed 849% more food in March compared with the previous year. The second largest increase in western Massachusetts was 748%. At the Pittsfield Salvation Army Pantry. The Grace Klein Community Food Pantry in Jefferson County, which has the largest number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in Alabama, provided 5,076 individuals with food boxes last week, a 90% increase on the previous week, end quote from The Guardian. In America, the National Guard and police are helping handle and distribute food. Food bank workers are getting sick with COVID-19, or they may be afraid to come to work or to volunteer at what they used to do. Now they're staying at home. Donations are down. And as so many fear for their own livelihood, and so many are now unemployed, millions of Americans, lineups of cars in multiple U.S. cities extend for miles, looking for a drive-through food bank. This is another sign of the hidden collapse. Looking at the pandemic in India, we find yet another example where religious groups feel they are above the law of nature. Across the Middle East, but particularly in Southeast Asia, we find the fundamentalist group Taqlibi Jamaat. There are somewhere between 15 and 80 million of them. In March, thousands traveled to New Delhi for mass prayer. They became super spreaders, at one point creating about a third of all cases in India. Of course, the endemic religious hatred was stimulated, leading to more persecution of Muslims there. The disease sets loose whatever sickness of hate is brewing in a country. Another prayer meeting in March set off a series of infections in Malaysia and Indonesia. Be ready to hear more about Indonesia, which hardly has a health system, for over 100 million people living in close quarters on the relatively small island of Java. A few American fundamentalist churches have continued to meet despite official warnings. In just one example, a Kentucky revival meeting led to an outbreak there, including inside the General Electric Aviation Plant in Madisonville. We have the South Korean church, for example, where thousands became infected after concealing travel to Wuhan in China. We see the result of denying that microorganisms are real, that science is real, and belief cannot change the basic operations of nature. Now we see where that leads. Maybe we can handle the pandemic and climate change as the greatest emergency humans face. I'm Alex Smith. Let's go to our guests.
Radio EcoShock.
As African Americans die in extraordinary numbers during the coronavirus pandemic, maybe we can find food at the root of this tragedy. Complications from food-related illnesses like diabetes, heart conditions, and obesity are already, unfortunately, a pandemic inside the Black community, and we want to know why. Malik Yakini is working to change that deadly system. He's bringing control and empowerment back to the community in Detroit. Formerly a school principal, Malik helps run D-Town Farm. He is co-founder and executive director of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, and he's a member of the National Food Justice Alliance. Malik Yakini, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
In any other time, I would just sit back and listen to you about food and the work to be done, but we are in a pandemic, and our listeners are thinking about that. Did you think my linking food to the high percentage of Black deaths in cities from Detroit through Chicago to Philly, is that a fair one?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely fair. And actually, it's refreshing because you're the first journalist who I've heard make that link. And so, you know, food interacts with every other aspect of our lives, and certainly the kind of health disparities that we see in Black communities throughout the United States are caused, at least in part, by the lack of access to high-quality, nutrient-dense foods. And so those foods are kind of the building block of human health and the building block of strong immune systems. So what we see in many urban communities, and sometimes in the U.S., urban is kind of a code word for Black because many cities are either predominantly Black or have very large Black and brown populations. So what we see often, though, is that, number one, many grocery stores have abandoned kind of the inner cities, the core cities, as we saw white flight in the 1960s and 70s, and we saw suburban subdivisions being built outside of cities. Many times grocery stores would kind of follow that population density and would locate in those suburban subdivisions, and we see fewer and fewer of those full-service grocery stores in places like Detroit. And in fact, specifically in Detroit, when I was growing up in the 1960s, there were at least six or seven national chain grocery stores in Detroit, and each one of them had multiple locations throughout the city. So almost wherever you were within the city, you were within walking distance of a full-service, nationally-owned grocery store. As of 2007, when Farmer Jack closed its last stores in Detroit, there were no more national chain groceries in Detroit. Now, to be fair, there's a series of maybe 70 or 80 independently-owned grocery stores in Detroit, but far too often the quality of the food sold in those stores is lacking when compared to the quality of food sold in the suburbs. Far too often the hygienic conditions in those stores leave a lot to be desired, and far too often people working in the stores are disrespectful to the community members who are residents of the community in which they operate. And so what we found in places like Detroit is that often people, particularly people that don't have access to automobiles, that's another factor I want to throw into this discussion, transportation is related to food security because you have to be able to get to where the food is. So in a place like Detroit, where about 40% of the residents don't own an automobile, and also in Detroit we don't have a robust public transportation system, what often happens is that people go to places which are in walking distance of their homes. And far too often, those locations are gas stations and what we call in Detroit party stores, or what they call on the East Coast bodegas, places that sell potato chips, cigarettes, lottery tickets, soda pop, and the like. So many people are getting lots of their calories from either these party stores or from gas stations. And those calories are what we call empty calories. They're not really high in nutrients, and they don't help to build the kind of strong immunodefense that we need to ward off not only the COVID-19, the coronavirus that's causing COVID-19, but also to ward off other illnesses that impact Black communities.
And I suspect some listeners will say, well, why don't African Americans make better food choices? But you've just answered that question. I think Michelle Obama was kind of a leader in her quiet way. She planted a vegetable garden at the White House, which Trump ripped out, of course. And she was instrumental in getting Walmart to start selling affordable fresh produce. And that was a bit of a help. Talk to us about your roots here, the D-Town Farm.
Well, you know, you mentioned former First Lady Michelle Obama. And interestingly, I was invited to the White House when she made this announcement about Walmart and Walgreens selling food. And I have to tell you, I was really a bit disappointed because on a certain level, you know, having Walmart or Walgreens sell food to urban areas provides greater access to food. The other problem, though, is that it undermines community self-determination. And so, you know, trying to think about how we build local strong food systems from the ground up, which are really controlled by community members as opposed to being controlled by multinational corporations, would be the preferred route. And that's the type of work that we're doing in Detroit and is happening throughout the United States, where you have churches, community organizations that are building farms, that are creating food policy councils, that are creating food co-ops, and thinking about how we localize the creation of food systems so that the dollars spent within that food system stay in the communities that are spending those dollars, and we create community empowerment as opposed to only thinking about access in the sense that you have a store that you can go in and get food and not thinking about what happens to the profits on the other end. But certainly, you know, Michelle Obama speaking up about food insecurity was very helpful, and it helped the gardening movement, and it helped people begin to think more critically about the need for food justice. But specifically in Detroit, the organization that I lead is called the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, and we've done several things in the 14 years, I'm sorry, that we've been in existence since 2006. The first thing is that we operate Detroit's largest farm, which you mentioned earlier, which is D-Town Farm, which is a 7-acre farm at which we grow somewhere between 35 and 40 different fruits, vegetables, and herbs each year that we sell to individuals, primarily at farmers markets and also to farm stands at our farm, and we sell to a few wholesale customers as well. And so what we're doing is we're producing kind of hyper-local produce that is very high in nutrients, and also we're reducing the carbon footprint that it takes to transport food. So in the United States, food is transported an average of 1,500 miles from the point that the food is produced to where it's consumed, and most of that food is transported via truck. Those trucks run on diesel fuel, which spew a great deal of carbon into the atmosphere and are a contributor to global warming. And so by growing food closer to where we have population density and having to transport it fewer miles, we're actually contributing to a healthier ecosystem. So that's one of the things that that we do, the farm. We also train a cohort of farmers each year through formal internship programs and through volunteer opportunities at our farm. We also at our farm model rainwater retention. So we have a pond that we put in that can collect about 50,000 gallons of rainwater, which we use as a secondary source for watering our crops. We're also connected to the municipal water system. We do large-scale composting. We do beekeeping. We have a children's area and have public events. We do lots and lots of tours. And really what we're trying to do is not only grow more hyper-local nutrient-dense produce, but we're also trying to help challenge people's thinking about what a more localized, fair, and just food system might look like. So in addition to the farm, we also have a youth program called the Food Warriors Youth Development Program that functions at a school on the east side of Detroit and a church on the west side of Detroit. And in both of those locations, we have children build raised bed gardens. We show them how to maintain those gardens, how to harvest the foods, how to prepare them in healthy ways, and we train them to be food justice advocates in their own community. A big project that we're working on now is called the Detroit Food Commons. We're building a new building on Detroit's main street. We haven't begun construction yet, let me be clear. We will be building a new building on Detroit's main street, a 34,000-square-foot, two-story building, the first floor of which will be occupied by the Detroit People's Food Co-op, a cooperatively owned grocery store, which will specialize in foods that are higher quality. We're kind of selling two types of food. We're selling what in the industry is called natural and organic food, and then we're also selling what we're calling clean conventional food. And then the last thing I'll say is that we also, near the beginnings of our organization in 2006, spoke to the Detroit City Council, and we were critical of the city for not having a comprehensive food policy. And so we were appointed to head a task force, which then wrote the City of Detroit's food security policy. And one of the most important aspects of that policy is that it called for the creation of the Detroit Food Policy Council, which we also stewarded into existence and chaired for its first 2 years. That organization continues to exist independently of our organization now. It has its own board, its own office, its own funding sources, but it continues to serve as an advisory body to the city government.
So African Americans have a huge, long culture of farming, but maybe that was seen as a kind of poverty of the sharecropping, something that a younger generation wanted to get away from towards a freedom in the cities as they saw it. Now it almost sounds like we need to reverse that and go back.
Yeah, well, we have a global problem. Across the planet, farming is not really seen as honorable work, and urban life is seen as somehow hipper and cooler and more sophisticated than rural life. So throughout the planet, you have people leaving rural areas, coming to the cities. So that's a global phenomenon. But people of African descent in the Western Hemisphere have a particular challenge. As you noted, part of that challenge is the history of sharecropping, but even the more egregious system of enslavement that people of African descent were subjected to for 200 years or so in both the United States and also in parts of the Caribbean and parts of Central and South America. And so the tremendous trauma associated with both enslavement and sharecropping has many black people kind of hesitant to get into urban agriculture, to get into agriculture at all. So part of the work of our organization is really to reshift our thinking, to reframe agriculture from the kind of framework many of our people see it, you know, within the context of enslavement and sharecropping, to reframe it as an act of self-determination, a way that communities can pull themselves up and create health and vibrancy for themselves.
As we speak, seed stores have sold out. I mean, Johnny Seeds said, well, we don't have any more seeds for you, and baby chicks are hard to get. Millions of Americans are suddenly out of work and out of money, and they're wondering how to feed themselves. Maybe this is the moment, Malik Yakini, the moment for food change.
Yeah, I think we have a tremendous opportunity, which is embedded in this terrible crisis that we're all facing. So, you know, one of the things that happens is that when you slow down, and the whole society is slowed down now with many people working at home, it gives you the chance to be more introspective and more critical in your thought. And so I'm hoping that we have a shift that occurs, not just in terms of food, but in terms of thinking about the relationship of human beings to each other, thinking about the relationship of human beings to the earth, as well as thinking about our relationship to food. So I can tell you for sure that I've had more people call me in the last 3 weeks asking about starting gardens than I have in the last 10 years. So seeing on the media grocery store shelves bare, I think, shocked a lot of people into reality, and it's helped us to see the fragility in the industrial food system that provides a great deal of our food, that there's all kind of possible ways that that system can break down, and one of the ways that can impact it is, of course, disease, but there's all kinds of other ways that we can have potential breakdowns in that system. Because at this point, it's a global system. And so these huge global systems are going to break down in time. It's not a question of if they'll break down. It's a question of when. And so this has shocked a lot of people into reality. So people are much more interested now in both self-reliance in terms of food production. People are interested in cooperative ventures now. And many people are rethinking our relationship to the earth. You know, part of the problem with this whole pandemic has to do with how human beings view our relationship with the earth. The great Indian farmer and thought leader Vandana Shiva wrote an article the other day about the virus, food, and humanity. And one of the things that she pointed out is that many religious traditions have this idea of human beings having dominion over the earth or being here to dominate the earth and the other animals and plants who co-inhabit the planet with us. And so she is suggesting that one of the reasons that we're seeing these viruses, which have been transferred from wild animals to human beings, has to do with the encroachment of human beings on these formerly wild areas. And that is all rooted in this idea that we were put here to have dominance over the earth. And so I'm hoping that not only do we have a shift in terms of people gravitating more towards gardening and farming, but that we have a shift in terms of rethinking our relationship to the earth and not seeing the earth as simply something that we extract from, but seeing the earth as kind of our divine mother, which is the case in many indigenous traditions, which we have to respect, and we have the responsibility of being the stewards and caretakers of.
Now, on the nightly news, I hear about hot spots in America, and they talk about New York, and they talk about Louisiana, and they mention Chicago, and sort of as an afterthought, they throw in Detroit. But I can't actually really find out, except by reading Detroit newspapers, what's happening in Detroit. What are you seeing from your viewpoint?
Detroit is being hit very hard by the COVID-19 pandemic. I know several people who have been diagnosed as positive. I know a few people who have died on Facebook every day. There's pretty much a continuous kind of listing of relatives of people that I know personally who have died. And so at this point, there have been hundreds of people in the city of Detroit who have died, something like 1,400 people in the state of Michigan. Interestingly, though, out of those 1,400 people in the state of Michigan, 42% of the people who have died have been African American, while we form just 14% of the population of the state of Michigan. So we're dying at three times the rate that you would expect to see represented in those statistics. In Chicago, black people are about a third of the population, but represent about 70% of the deaths. We're seeing similar statistics out of New Orleans, as you mentioned, and out of Milwaukee, and now out of St. Louis. And so the reality is that race impacts everything in American life. Racism is a constant factor that black people have to deal with. And it's not just a question of, you know, the kind of overt discrimination that we might sometimes face, but it's a question of the daily microaggressions that create stress. And we know that one of the things that breaks down the immune system is stress. And so racism creates stress, and that's one of the factors in addition to food that is causing a higher death rate among African Americans. Also, poverty is a factor. Now, clearly not all black people are in poverty, and not all black people who are dying of COVID-19 are in poverty. But the vast majority of African Americans are either at or below the poverty line. And so typically when you don't have adequate income, you don't have adequate health care, it affects your food choices. You often have to work riskier jobs. We're seeing in Detroit that, you know, because as I mentioned earlier, 40% of the population doesn't have automobiles, that those folks, if they still have to go to work, have to ride public transportation, which then puts them more in harm's way. You know, any job that exposes you more to the general public is going to put you more in harm's way. And then finally, I saw something yesterday that also suggests that environmental factors may be playing a role in the rates of COVID-19 that we're seeing in places like Detroit, that air pollution and its impact on the respiratory system can make a person more susceptible to being diagnosed with COVID-19.
Absolutely. We've had experts on this show talking about the hidden effects of air pollution and long-term effects on the people's health. And I could go way back to 2007 Radio EcoShock, where we talked with a scientist who studied in Harlem and the actual air that people were breathing there, and it was poisonous. And there's just so many problems here that need to be unwound, but I have to believe that good food is a good place to start and a good place to get local community developing for itself. What else would you like to tell our listeners as we wrap up here, Malik?
Well, you know, the thing about the food movement is it impacts everyone. You know, when we try to build movements for justice, oftentimes we have various divisions because people have different ideologies, different religions, different views on gender. All these things are separated. But the thing about food is it's a great uniter. It's a common denominator. And so, you know, we have a tremendous opportunity now to think about justice in general, but also to think about how we create a more just food system so that everyone has equal access to high-quality food, because clearly this impacts the health of individuals, the health of communities, and the health of the nation as a whole. And so everyone, you know, when you take a bite of food, in a sense, you're making a political act. And so we want people to think more critically about food and how they can use their food dollars and their food choices and also their voices and their activism to shape a more just, sustainable, and resilient food system.
We have been speaking with Malik Yakini from the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, and check out foodfirst.org. I'll put links to all this in my own show blog, ecoshock.org. Malik, thank you for helping us, and let's keep in touch. We do have common interests.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
David Spratt is the author of the book and blog Climate Code Red. He is a senior researcher at the Breakthrough National Center for Climate Restoration. David and co-author Ian Dunlop published their devastating critique of climate science, What Lies Beneath, the Inside Story of Political Failure and Scientific Reticence on Climate Change's Existential Risks. And now they have out a new report, Fatal Calculations, just in time for the global pandemic. Do we have time for climate change anymore? From Australia, David Spratt, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Alex, great to be with you and your listeners.
It's wild you bring out a new report on how bad economics lulled corporations and governments to sleep on climate change. And now we have this massive turning point, not of anyone's choosing. Do you think the former economy will collapse? Will it rebuild as was or what?
Look, in terms of the pandemic, I think it's really far too early to tell. I mean, a lot of things are being turned upside down. They're not stable. We don't know where they're going. We don't know whether the global financial system is at the edge of collapse. You never do until it happens, or whether it's able to deal with these circumstances. We don't know how deep or long the recessions will be. So I think a lot of this is a matter of speculation, but there are some things of interest. I mean, most importantly, that we've actually seen an emergency response to an overwhelming threat, which has implications for climate change. And we've also seen governments take a leadership role and be prepared to do all the things that were told for climate change they couldn't do, like think about the future, run large deficits, protect people, rather than the economy in the short term. So there are obviously a lot of learnings from this.
Well, right, David. Most of the moves we called on for years to prevent the developing climate disaster, they were ignored as too radical. Like ending fossil power travel, shutting down the most polluting industries, switching to online instead of commuting all the time. Now it's suddenly happening due to COVID-19. We could have done this decades ago.
Well, of course we could, and that was the point when we wrote Climate Code Red in 2008, to say that an emergency mobilisation is both possible, and we know because of historical antecedents like the war economy, a language which people are using again today, and out of necessity. And we've seen when the necessity is perceived and the threat is perceived as being right in front of our face, we are capable of going into this mode. And that mode is where a government makes the threat, whether it be a pandemic or climate, which is really a much larger threat, the first priority of business. They devote all the necessary resources to it. You have generally, with some exceptions, a large degree of bipartisanship, the speeding up of science and research to solve the problems which are outstanding, and the devotion of all the necessary resources to solve the problem. I mean, the debts that are now being run up by governments, which are necessary, would be unthinkable 6 months ago in a neoliberal environment, political economy environment. So in circumstances which were unthinkable, unthinkable things are able to be done.
Probably the single greatest threat of COVID-19 is that by the time we see symptoms, by the time we get really sick, the person has already been spreading the disease unknowingly for a week or more, and some people never get symptoms, but they have it and they spread the disease. Surely climate change is hard for the same reason. By the time cities flood and the landscape burns, it's way too late. What can we learn here?
Well, you're exactly right. And one of the reasons it turned out to be problems around the world was that there are obviously a lot of passive or asymptomatic transmitters of the disease through the globalized economy, particularly trade and air travel and tourism. And when people woke up and those symptoms manifested, it was too late. So the pandemic is a small version of climate change, and it's on steroids in that things are condensed and happening in weeks, which in climate change take years and months. But, I mean, the point is the same, and we see that those countries such as Singapore, Taiwan and South Korea, which have learned firsthand the lessons of the SARS virus in 2003 and knew what to do, acted very differently from the rest of the world. I mean, they tested early, they ramped up, they did all the things that they'd found that they hadn't done in SARS, and it made a very big difference to those countries versus the rest of the world. So the principal lesson, as you say, is that by the time the problem manifests, it's too late, or what you have to do is much more difficult and much more disruptive. And of course, that's the climate change writes that story on a larger picture.
In great big capital letters, yes. And for decades, humans spent trillions on the military and other harmful things instead of retooling into a renewable, low-energy society. And now, of course, most governments are handing out, as you say, vast amounts of what I call fantasy money, mostly to banks and business. The common person will get the leftovers. But they will then say, we cannot afford to change now. How can we handle that?
That's the big issue, of course, isn't it? A lot of people are speculating that this is the end of neoliberalism and everything's going to be overturned. I mean, my great fear is that at the end of this period, when the virus is under control, we have a vaccine or it's suppressed, then we will go back to, oh, now we've got to pay off the debts and we've got to even do more belt tightening than before. So I think the really important thing out of this is to draw some of the big lessons about climate change. And I think they are, firstly, that an emergency mobilisation, devoting the resources necessary to solve a problem is possible and necessary and feasible, and that's what we've just proved. The second thing, which hasn't had much discussion, is learning from the failure of the response to the pandemic by and large. Pandemics are listed and considered around the world to be a catastrophic risk, almost an existential risk. Certainly, for example, if you look at the role that smallpox played in depopulating the native indigenous populations of the Americas, where perhaps 90% of people were killed, it is clearly pandemics can be an existential risk. But countries simply didn't understand, despite all the rhetoric and despite all the policy papers and scenarios, it is clear from their actions that governments did not understand that this pandemic could be an existential risk, and they didn't act as if it was. And the reasons why they didn't do that are really important to understand, because those same reasons apply to climate change.
Exactly. So let's talk about your new report written with Alia Armistead. It's called Fatal Calculations: How Economics Has Underestimated Climate Damage and Encouraged Inaction. Why did you do this?
Well, as you mentioned in the introduction, a couple of years ago, Ruby published a report called What Lies Beneath on what we called scientific reticence, particularly in the work of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in their reports, which underestimated the risks, didn't look at what are called the fat tail or the worst possibilities, and generally went for middle-of-the-road outcomes. And as Professor John Schellenhuber said in before to that report, at times like this when the risks are unprecedented, you shouldn't worry about the probabilities, the 50% or the 60%, but you should worry about the bad possibilities. And it had always occurred to me that, as with the science, there was a parallel problem with the economics, that the economics applied to climate change is also reticent and deceitful in underestimating the problem and therefore encouraging inaction. And, of course, the largest part of this story, interesting given that the pandemic has happened and the response, is the argument that we shouldn't act on climate change if it's going to cost us anything or be economically disruptive at all. And that sort of line of argument is embedded in the core of the economic analysis of climate change and the cost-benefit analysis models, which have that assumption at the core of their being.
Yes, I was stunned to read in your report the following, quote, former Prime Minister John Howard on 5 February 2007 told the ABC's Late Line that it would be less comfortable for some than it is now if average global temperatures rose 4 to 6 degrees centigrade by the end of the century. Just like Trump and the pandemic, They can't imagine the reality, the well-documented reality. Where is Australia now on climate?
Well, we're not doing well because we have a Conservative government. The successor is John Howard's government, which is essentially a government in denial about the problem, a policy which I call delay and denial. They still want to open new coal-fired power stations. They want to make Australia the largest exporter of fossil fuels in the world. And we are just about the largest exporter of liquefied natural gas in the world at the moment. So this is a government in full denial, despite a really heartfelt and large community campaign, which has resulted in the closing down of a number of coal-fired power stations and has so far stopped the development of the largest new coal field in the world in Queensland. So we have a mixed story here. Well, we'd only just recovered from the fires, which were made worse by climate change. They were unprecedented in their nature and shocked the system. We'd only just recovered from them when the pandemic hit. So I don't think there's been a full political accounting for the fires yet. But so far, hard to see much change in movement. I think these are politically very volatile times.
A terrible 1-2 punch for Australia.
And we've just had a new survey of the Great Barrier Reef, one of the world's seven natural wonders, a coral system of which 3/4 had been lost over the last 40 years. And there's been another bleaching, that is, warmer seas have killed off another swathe of the reef, and they say perhaps one of the worst bleachings on record. So this is, you know, the reality that climate change is here, not in the future, and climate change is already dangerous, not a future proposition.
But with the imminent threat of pandemic, many people are ready to postpone talk and action on climate until it's over, maybe a year or two. The UN Climate Change Conference, COP26, was postponed in Scotland. It's been delayed for a year. But, you know, given 3 decades of failure to address climate change, while emissions rose and rose, I'm not sure that the COP process really matters anyway. Your thoughts?
Well, the UN Secretary General, in a somewhat unfortunate term of phrase, announced a couple of weeks ago that the climate issue for the United Nations was on the back burner. He could have said off the boil. It's unfortunate language. But yes, it has been deferred. Look, I'm not sure that those processes make any difference anymore since the UN climate policy-making processes were established more than 25 years ago. We've seen global emissions increase by more than 50%. We've seen the temperature continue to increase, perhaps at an accelerating rate. We are likely to hit 1.5 degrees, which will be very dangerous by the end of this decade. And I'm not sure that those processes have really done much good. If you look at the last big COP's talk in Paris, what came out of that was voluntary unenforceable commitments, some of which haven't been honoured. And the Paris path is between 3 and 5 degrees of warming. That is around 3 without taking the carbon cycle feedbacks and the nonlinear climate processes into account. 5, perhaps 5 with them. And we know that that range of warming 3 to 5 is catastrophic. National security people say that 3 degrees of warming would likely to lead to a situation where the international or the world would be characterised by the term outright chaos. Professor Kevin Anderson in the UK has said, and many others agree, that 4 degrees is incompatible with the maintenance of civilisation. And earlier this year, Johann Rockström, who's taken over from John Schellenhuber as the head of the Potsdam Institute in Germany, reaffirmed that if we got to 4 degrees, perhaps the human population would be reduced to 1 billion people. So this is a catastrophic failure of policymaking, and I, as you say, I wonder whether those processes have run their course, and we have to look more to the interests of nations and regions and really big deals, bilateral deals, for example, between the EU and China, as the way to provide some leadership.
Yes, because right now, a lot of big governments are not working on it either. In fact, America, Australia, and Canada are making it easier for fossil fuel companies to pollute even more. We are slashing regulations meant to protect society and nature, and we're doling out billions in emergency aid to the wealthiest companies in the world.
Including propping up the high-polluting airline industry, global travel industry, which is precisely the industry which allowed the rapid spread of this virus.
Yeah, the U.S. is giving them $50 billion just to tide them over for a little while.
Yes, well, look, obviously there's going to be a reckoning. I mean, the stimulus, economic stimulus saviour package has just been directed literally at propping up the economy as it is in its present structure and functioning, which is not the way we need it to be if we're going to get out of the climate crisis. But I think over the next few months, we can't have the pandemic as being 90% of the news every day. Our fear, our overwhelming fear and engagement with this issue, I think will diminish a bit, and then we'll have to go back to a conversation, as the Club of Rome and others have pointed to, of the risks of stimulus just perpetuating the status quo when everybody says we now need the most rapid of transitions when we need a climate emergency. So that is difficult in these circumstances because the tension is elsewhere. But as we've said, on the other hand, we've demonstrated that a mode of action necessary to address the problem is in fact possible and has just occurred.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is David Spratt from climatecodered.org. David, we are bound to have climate-driven emergencies during the months to come, even during the pandemic. What would have happened if Australia had those recent record wildfires while illness made travel and groups of people working together very dangerous?
This is the problem that people really don't understand and governments don't understand, is that you have catastrophic risks which are very difficult to manage, but you also have system failures where those risks intersect. I spent a little bit of time looking in the national security area and the military in Australia, which is a relatively small beast compared to the United States and other places, say that if they were forced to respond to a bushfire, and we brought out the military to do some tasks in Australia, and there were Category 5 hurricanes in the Pacific and they had to send disaster relief, and something else happened to our near north and forces required, they simply don't have the capacity to respond. And this is the question. When these catastrophic risks intersect, and we have to remember that modern society, globalisation, the more rapid transfer of movement of people has actually made this pandemic worse. When these crises intersect, our capacity to respond will be overwhelmed. So it's not that one risk plus another one risk equals two. It actually equals three, four, or five.
Lost in the news on that theme. Right now, New Orleans is suffering the fastest growing death rate on the planet from COVID-19. And at the same time, the waters in the Gulf of Mexico are really hot, way above average. So we have to imagine a major hurricane striking Texas and Louisiana, again, another Katrina. I don't know how humans are going to cope with these double and triple punches as they come, climate and COVID together.
That's the question. And that's why if you have a look at the relatively dispassionate analysis of national security experts, they see around the world, particularly in a perhaps a 3-degree warmer world, that you have the intersections of these problems of more extreme weather events that you've talked about, the rising sea levels, the desertification. We've seen, a minor example, I hate to use the word minor, but in Syria where desertification and drought in the end, as a consequence of a civil war that was made worse by climate change, led to the displacement of more than 10 million people. And that displacement to Europe actually caused a political crisis in Europe, and it spread around. Now, that's just a small element of what would happen as the dry subtropics simply can no longer support agriculture. And the world that is understood and imagined at 3 degrees beyond the physical impacts, when we get into the political consequences, the state breakdown, the forced migration, the food and water shortages, is of a total system breakdown.
Would you tell us about the National Climate Emergency Summit in Melbourne in the middle of February, possibly the last such meeting other than virtual space we'll see for a little while?
I'm research director for Breakthrough, and our umbrella body, the Sustainable Living Festival, has a large event each year. And this year, on the 14th and 15th of February, that was devoted to a national climate emergency summit held in the splendour of Melbourne's 19th century Victorian town hall. About 2,000 people registered. There were more than 100 speakers and presenters and facilitators. So really a very large event with a lot of very eloquent voices. So it really was a chance for all those people who'd been working on climate emergency declarations at the local government level and in community campaigns to come together to think about where we've got to hear from people like Professor Michael E. Mann, who was visiting from the United States, was on sabbatical here, and as soon as he arrived, he got hit by the fires, and I think his whole research project changed. And in fact, he was forced to return to the United States prematurely because of the travel bans from the pandemic. So he experienced a couple of intersecting climate crises, but a really wonderful event. All the sessions are online. They were videoed and they're available. If people just look up Climate Emergency Summit Melbourne, the full list of videos and workshops is there.
Beautiful. I'm going to check that out. Now, here's something else that really bugs me. Countries from the United States to Australia routinely report their direct greenhouse gas emissions, and the rest of the numbers don't mean much. And Canada does the same. But David, what about the cumulative emissions from burning all our tar sands that we export, the coal that Australia exports, the natural gas that so many countries are exporting? Why don't we add up the real emissions we cause? And have you calculated what Australia's real emissions are when all the fossil fuel exports are added in?
Well, this is, of course, a very contentious question because the world has offloaded a large amount of its manufacturing to China and what were considered the lower wage economies, developing economies, India, Vietnam, and so on. So everybody looks at China and say, my goodness, there's a huge increase in emissions there. But, I mean, a good proportion of those are related to products which are exported back for consumption in the West. And yet China is lumped with the responsibility for them. The same thing happens in Australia, where we are a very large exporter of thermal coal, metallurgical coal and liquid gas. But we only count the emissions associated with directly mining them, the fugitive emissions and the transport and the building of the infrastructure and so on. But when those fossil fuels are burnt somebody else, that's somebody else's responsibility. The actual effect of Australia's export fossil fuels and attributed to Australia, our emissions profile would more than triple, as one example.
And it's true of Canada and so many countries, Saudi Arabia and on. And Russia. And now I think, though, David, that part of the problem is that people hear 3 degrees centigrade or, say, 5 Fahrenheit, and then they add that to their picture of an average day. Doesn't sound too bad. So it's a few degrees warmer. We can handle that. We'll just crank up the AC. They don't know that land will warm much more than the massive ocean. They don't understand natural feedback loops. They don't get exponential math that's involved. Can't picture abrupt climate change. And it seems at times that almost no amount of science or rational explanation can reach enough people in time. And so in a way, we have a pandemic of ignorance that threatens our future terribly.
That's true. And it's any science is relatively difficult to communicate, particularly to people who are only seemingly interested and don't have some background or interest in the issue. But I think if we look at the pandemic, there's something really interesting has happened. We've seen some really decisive political leadership where politicians, for a change, have actually done what they're elected to do, which is to protect the people and lead. And there have been some very good examples of political leaders at a national, regional, even at a city level, being able to explain in fairly simple but useful terms to people what's going on with the virus. What are the choices? Here's bending the curve. This is what will happen if we act. This is what will happen if we didn't act. Now, those people are just as capable of communicating like that about climate change, but they have so far chosen not to. So in that, I think there's a really valuable lesson that if leaders decide to lead, they do have the capacity to take people with them, to encourage behaviour change and to educate people. We can't expect the scientists to do that last level of education. That is up to our leaders, and it has just been proven that it can be done effectively.
So in your new report, Fatal Calculations, you say mainstream economists, the ones who bolster government do-nothingism, they just leave out serious risks. Can you give us a couple of examples of what's left out?
Well, look, there's lots of things left out. I mean, all economics of climate change is based on what anybody who ever did Economics 101 learned, that is a thing called, a much abused term, cost-benefit analysis, where you work out the cost of acting or not acting and the benefits of acting or not acting, and you add it up and you work out what's the best thing to do. Is it better to rent or buy or all those sorts of things? So it's based on comparing sums of money. So the problems are several. The first is that if climate change, with its high-end possibilities, which we've talked about at 3 or 4 degrees, actually brings human civilization to an end, which it will, then you simply can't quantify or put a number on the damage. The damage is so high, it's infinite. It can't be estimated. And as soon as you put an infinite number into a cost-benefit equation, the equation can't work, because what you learn is that no matter how much you spend to avoid that problem, it's much better than the world coming to an end. So I was really taken by a guy called Spencer Glendon, who's now a senior fellow at the Woods Hole Research Center in the Northeast US and was a former director of an investment management company. And he said, and I quote, "The economics of climate change will be seen as one of the worst mistakes humans have made, much worse than any of the denialists." And I think that's a problem, because there is an underestimation of the risks. And the most notorious case, which we start our report with, is that of a guy called William Nordhaus, who is the godfather of economy, climate, energy system models called integrated assessment models, a very crude form of cost-benefit analysis, who 2 years ago was awarded the Nobel Prize for Economics for his work as a pioneer in this field. And for decades, and even at the Nobel Prize ceremony, he got up and said, if we get to 4 degrees of warming, I think the cost will only be about 4% of the economy. And he in fact said that 3 to 4 degrees of warming is the optimum path from his economics point of view. Now, this is a scandal. This is a delusion so profound. And yet his work and the work of his associates, the climate economists, has been at the core of the IPCC and the UN policy-making process. So there is this systematic underestimation of the damage, so severe that it's hard to believe, and that simply makes their work not credible and irrelevant to the decisions we have to make.
Recently with the pandemic, David Spratt, we have seen a few empty food shelves. Perhaps for the first time in our lives, we take our plentiful food for granted. How does developing climate change play into Australian food security, as an example? And what does it mean for those countries who depend on food exports from your country?
Well, this is, of course, is the big issue. Australia produces more food than it needs, particularly a large exporter of staple grains like wheat. And we saw in the Arab Spring that one of the main drivers of the Arab Spring was wheat shortages brought on by simultaneous events, that is, wildfires in Russia and a phase of the monsoon in China, which both drove down wheat production in those countries. And the Middle East is the most dependent region in the world on wheat exports. The price of wheat tripled, and that became the essential driver of the Arab Spring. So, you know, we have history in this area. We are now, the world relies on just-in-time supply chains rather than storing, being more self-sufficient, having manufacturing capacity at home. The world is more dependent on just-in-time systems. So I don't know what the experience was in other countries, but certainly we had some runs on goods here which were not rationally justified, because Australia can produce enough food and toilet paper and basic things to keep on going. But I imagine other parts of the world, if this was sustained, certainly in Australia, people selling goods have been unable to get shipping out of China and other parts of India, other parts of Asia for the last couple of months. So we can see that a climate dislocation of the global transport shipping system and of globalised production would have dramatic consequences.
We have talked about huge risk and worry, but now to the other side of your coin, what are the benefits if we reshape this economy away from fossil fuels as we emerge from this pandemic shutdown? What do we have to gain, even at this late date?
Look, I think what we have to gain is that we, as a modern functioning society, will be here in 100 years' time. I mean, that is now the choice. I was really drawn to a couple of comments by Professor John Schellenhuber recently. I mean, Schellenhuber was the director of the Potsdam Institute, still is an advisor to Pope Francis and has been an advisor to both Angela Merkel and the EU, one of the most eminent climate scientists in the world. And he said, you know, if the climate system and the tipping points interact and the cascades develop, then this is the most important question to understand because, and I quote, right now it would be the end of our civilization. So that's what I think is at stake, whether we're actually going to be here or not. So the benefits are overwhelming. The other choices, which we're now on, can't be talked about. Certainly we will see an energy system, a renewable energy system, where the cost curve is already dropping below that of fossil fuels, which will be cheaper, more decentralised and able to be located in remote locations. An energy system which is actually viable and sustainable, both for stationary energy and for transport. I think we'll see a rejigging of manufacturing. I mean, our use of cement and steel and how we produce steel will change. I think out of this pandemic, perhaps a reflection on how and why we consume and how we organise society and the benefits of social solidarity and perhaps even being a bit less obsessed by working 70 hours a week and having a bit more time with families and the importance of family and the people around us and the people in our neighbourhood and our street and how we might help each other. So I think there are a lot of opportunities out of this pandemic crisis.
Two quick questions. Is your new report just about Australia? And how can listeners get this report, Fatal Calculations?
Fatal Calculations is directed at an international audience. It's a big picture story of how economics has underestimated the cost, how policymakers have swallowed that, the reasons why economists have been involved in these fatal miscalculations, why many of the things we try and put an economic price upon, like ecosystems and human life, are beyond value. It is out and it's available at our website, which is breakthroughonline.org.au, or perhaps if people just Google breakthrough fatal calculations, they will find it because the report is called Fatal Calculations, How Economics Has Underestimated Climate Damage and Encouraged Inaction.
We have been speaking with David Spratt from climatecodered.org. Visit the Breakthrough National Center for Climate Restoration at their website, and I will put links to all this in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. David, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Please pass this program on to your friends. Get it free at ecoshock.org. And join me again next week